today and to try and answer questions you might have about him or what he's been talking about. I can only assure you that if you have often felt that you were left behind, that many others have had that experience too. On the other hand, if you felt profound feelings of indignation and anxiety, that's not out of the pattern either. He's a person to whom students and everybody indeed respond quite strongly one way or another. So I would like to be guided in this time by questions that you might have, perhaps about where we put QC in Rosenstock QC in development of Western thought, or maybe we might as well take it on a cosmic level. That's the level that he operates on. Or maybe you would explain, raise questions that had been discussed, and I might be able to illuminate them. Not guarantee it by any means. I am familiar with a good deal of his writing and thinking over some period of years now. So I invite your questions or queries or indignant outbursts or however you might care to respond. Yes?
I'd like to hear someone else make a distinction between people, public, and master.
Well, I heard that lecture and... when he first made this distinction. Do you want me to recapitulate what I understood he meant?
Yes.
In this book? Well, I think he felt that the public was a kind of passive and anonymous situation, and we keep talking in the United States about the public when we should perhaps better talk about people. You can't use the analogy, as you recall, of people in a theater, or I suppose you could take it in a lecture too, although one would think that you might transcend this status of the passive auditor as public in class. But I think he feels the masses are the undifferentiated the group that has no, the collectivity as opposed, well, if you want to transpose it into Martin Buber's terms, you could probably speak of the public as the collectivity. I think Buber uses that term, and the community as being that group of individuals who have some coherence, who are related in some meaningful way to each other. The mass would be just that undifferentiated. Maybe it would be very much the same as the collectivity, except it would extend beyond it. Los Angeles is a collectivity rather than a community. You might say of Santa Monica, within some limits, that it has some of the characteristics of a community. Now, you might say, in general, that we're part of a mass society. Now, I'm not sure that I'm doing justice to Husey's term. Meanings, I'm sure he unfolds richer ones, and maybe some of you here would speak to your understanding of this question, these points. Does that impress you as being reasonable? You don't look very impressed.
Yes. Where exactly would you place the importance of Melville?
Well, now you're asking me questions that are really directed at me as a person, or you ask me what does Rosenstock QC think Melville should represent? Mm-hmm. Wait, the last.
The last.
Well, that's always, of course, more difficult to answer. I haven't heard him talk about Melville. I think he sees Melville as the really supreme creative thinker in American life, not so much as the as the writer. He's impatient with the literary critics who haggle over his symbolism and over this or that aspect of his literary skill. Husey says, I think, and a number of critics, English critics, literary critics would support him, that Melville had no style at all to speak of, or an abominable style. But Husey is concerned with him about, in terms of what he had to say about the American situation. And I think this is a, I don't know of anybody who really speaks with as much insight and as much power about the American experience, and who, of course, supremely in Moby Dick and also in Pierre, deals with the agonies, the buried agonies of the 19th century. Nobody could endure Melville because Melville raised issues about American society, about American life, that nobody in the 19th century was willing to face or deal with. And it's only after he's been dead, safely dead, 50 or 75 years, that we even bring ourselves to look at the implications of Melville's writing, thinking.
Well, I'm now interested in your opinion in regards to Daniel Webster's reply to Hayne. Do you feel that this speech does answer our territorial problems that arise after war, and that this is so important that it perhaps might, this is the outcome of war, or?
Well, of course, Husey is obviously a startling, the encounter with Rosenstock Husey is a startling experience for anyone raised and nurtured in a traditional American academic curriculum or atmosphere, because a great deal of what he tries to come at is done by metaphor, in a sense, in the largest sense of metaphor, and by intuition. It's been fascinating to me to see, he's never taught a course like this before. He's never taught a course in American social history. I don't know what American social history is, really. That's his opportunity. Mr. Meyer taught an American social history that was Mr. Meyer's social history, and Rosenstock Husey teaches one that's very different indeed, and it started in this country. Otto Schlesinger Sr. at Harvard started a course which he called the Social and Cultural, Social Intellectual History of the United States, and it was simply a catalog. It was all the things that when the first streetcar ran, and when the first celluloid detachable collar was invented, and lead pencil, and all these things that Schlesinger felt. Schlesinger was a product of this idea of scientific history, this school in the United States, and this school thought that if you found out enough particular items, you see, and added them up, that you would somehow get an explanation. That's the way they thought, incorrectly, the scientists worked, that he collected great masses of data, and that from then a thoughtful consideration of these, or in a sense the data forced its answers on the, its meaning on the collector. But I don't think anybody takes as unsophisticated a view as history, of history as that. Schlesinger's course was enormously tedious, perfectly deadly, and never changed in 20 years. And Schlesinger, incidentally, I might say, in passing, was one of the people, I think, who did in Rosenstock Husey when he taught at Harvard, because there was a Schlesinger was very powerful at Harvard, and they got involved in a rather acrimonious dispute about whether history was a science or not a science. And of course, for Schlesinger in these days, it was heresy to say that it wasn't or wasn't about to become a science. And when Otto Schlesinger Jr., Sr.'s much more gifted and stylish son, was added to the department at Harvard, they simply, I always thought it was a classic, they simply took the course like a pie. Well, they didn't change it. They took Otto Schlesinger Sr., who taught American intellectual and social history, which had essayed out an absolute minimum intellectual content, believe me, changed the name of his course to American Social and Cultural History, and went on giving the same course, and Junior, his son, gave a course, and still does, called American Intellectual History. And in the American Social and Cultural History, on the cultural side, Otto Schlesinger Sr. the old gentleman, gave as much space to Gustav Borglum's thing in the Black Hills, this incredible head that's carved, these heads that are carved outside the mountain, that he did to Herman Melville. It was really a negation of any kind of real history. It made it all into a kind of dust heap or junk pile. But this type of history, Mr. Schlesinger was a personable and powerful man. He put his students in important posts in outstanding universities, and he had a great many of them. He was a kind of benign father figure. He didn't make severe intellectual demands on any graduate students. No graduate student ever need fear Mr. Schlesinger Sr. on intellectual grounds. And in consequence, the country, wherever, all around the country, wherever social history is taught now, the chances are 9 out of 10 that it's taught as Mr. Schlesinger Sr. taught it. And it obviously can't go on that way. I mean, nobody will put up with it. Mr. Meyer taught a course that was unique. Is unique, and teaches a course that's unique, and of course Rosenstock QC, who will never teach this particular course again, also teaches a course that's unique. Well, I haven't answered your question. I've gotten way away from it. You asked about Haynes, Webster and Haynes. Well, I would say you couldn't, if you assembled a panel of eminent historians and posed this question to them, they would be aghast. They would say, well, good heavens, how about the Industrial Revolution? Or, well, you could present the content of the course that Husey has offered to you here, and they would be staggered and incredulous, because it's an entirely unconventional approach to American history. But from what I've heard of it, and from what I know of it, it's been full of insights and ideas that you would never get anywhere else. So the question of whether Webster's reply to Hayne is a turning point, or this can be taken as a valid symbol of the heart of the American experience, or however you want to express it, this would certainly be a moot point. I mean, achieve any consensus on it. I think that Husey, by posing the thing for me, made me think of problems that I'd never thought of before, and opened up, what should we say, if I use the unhappy cliche, new vista into this whole problem of the West and empire in relation to, I think, the idea of after each war having some enormous new task to face and to conquer is an extremely interesting and, as far as I know, original idea. Yes?
What is Dr. Rosenstock Husey's place in the cosmos? What's his past, and how much of a following does he have today among historians?
Well, I would say among historians, he has none. As I suggested earlier, he arouses in the bosom of the orthodox academic historian nothing but anxiety and sometimes rage. And this has been his story, really, his career to a considerable extent. He went through, you see, all the Herculean labors of classic 19th century German scholarship and finished them by the time he was about 25. You see, I mean, he'd done then half a dozen monumental monographs, and he had done an original dissertation in law. He has, as you know, a doctorate in law and theology and some other philosophy. And then he said, in effect, he and a group of young Germans in this age, we can't go on teaching history in this academic tradition. The world is in revolution, in flames, in an extraordinary upheaval, and we have to direct all our thinking and all our work to the meaning of this. What does it mean, and what is the future of modern man? What is the significance of the destruction of Europe for the world? That sort of problem. And he started out with, I mean, it was perfectly, of course, fabulous generation, both the generation preceding it, historians like Wilhelm Dilthey, enormously important, and not even translated into American, into English, just in the last 10 years, a few thin selections from Dilthey have been translated and are available. Dilthey, Niebuhr, not Reinhold, but the historian, Otto von Guericke, the great scholar of natural law that Maitland so admired, who edited Husey's first monograph. All these people were, and of course, again, if you want to go back into it, you find Hegelian qualities and themes, and Meinecke, the great German intellectual historian of the late 19th and early 20th century, who died a very old man in the 50s, the creator of the Ideengeschichte, although Husey and Meinecke were very opposed, they were friends, and for a time friends. Meinecke was an older generation, not colleagues, but they were involved in the same tradition and represented different parts of it. Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, Husey was a Karl Barth was originally a member of this group of a dozen or so young German historians, Swiss. Well, Barth and Brunner were Swiss. Tillich, of course, Husey and Tillich have been acquaintances for many years. Started off with the same kind of sense of mission of addressing themselves to the dilemmas of modern society, and Tillich went off in the direction of being the representative of theology to the intellectual community, and has succeeded very well. Husey writes to him sometimes teasingly as Cardinal Manning, and signs his letters Cardinal Newman, because in a sense Tillich has been the Manning of this relationship, and Husey feels, in a sense, he has been the Newman, that he has, in a way, chosen academic exile and unpopularity with the academic world, because he is at every point challenged its values, and it's much more important than that. I think its methods, in a very deep sense, or let's say not methods. Its whole conception of what its enterprise is. I mean, is this a training, an enormous and elaborate training program, or is it something that has a responsibility for the reconstruction of our society? And then, of course, if you get the academic community to admit that this is part of its at least traditional responsibility, there's an enormous split over how this is to be done, you say, or how one approaches the truth by accumulation or by insight. It's fascinating. I had never gotten persuaded. Husey is diffident about speaking of his relations with people like Barth, and you see, Barth, they had established a press to print their works and to be their voice, so to speak, and Barth broke off from this. Barth said that it's the timeless, you see, that God is concerned with the timeless, not the temporal, and he worked for the reconstruction, if you know anything about modern, about neo-orthodoxy as a movement in Protestantism. Barth worked for the reconstruction of orthodoxy in a kind of timeless sense. Barth was very much nearer to the spirit, let's say, of German Lutheranism, the traditional spirit, which withdraws from the world rather than attempting to shape the world and to be involved in it. So that if you were to make out a diagram, I suppose it would be a very complicated one, probably. For QC, you have people like Hegel and Dilthey. You see, again, it's interesting that Dilthey, only now in America, becomes popular, or people are expressed interest in him. In the next 10 years, he'll have a great vogue, I suspect, because Dilthey is very strongly anti-scientific history. You see, he says history is a matter of an imaginative reconstruction of the past. It depends on sympathy, on insight, on entering into rapport with the age and the people that you're dealing with. And this was much more influential in Germany, because Germany always had this strong Weltschmerz mixed in with with its philosophy, the characteristic mention of the soul and the spirit. This is something that you find as a consistent line throughout 19th century German philosophy and German history and the writing about history. Along with it, you have this, of course, from the beginning in a person like von Rampen. But the West took, England and the United States took from von Rampen only this business that to write history is to say what was, what truly was, however the phrase goes. In other words, they went off on the line of scientific history, which in my view impoverished the whole historical enterprise. But in Germany itself, people like Meinecke and Dilthey before him and others took a much more humanistic, is not the right word, a history which sought existential history, if you will. And of course, if you have to call Husey anything, you call him an existentialist, in that he believes that that a man is only realized in his action, in his confrontation of life. And this has really been what he's given his life to. I don't know how much he talks about the different episodes of his life, but was one of the founders of the International Adult Education Movement, one of the first people in it, and established a labor college, work college in Frankfurt Academy, which still exists, and which was set up with the idea of making the industrial worker, giving him a real place, a human place in our society. And he started the German youth camps, work service camps. He's one of the early people in the field of the whole work service idea. And then in the 30s, when he came to this country, he was a consultant in the setting up of the CCCs, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Has he ever talked about Camp William James? This was a leadership training camp that he established in Vermont, which was to train leaders for the CCC camps, which, while they represented an interesting enterprise, fell quite short of their potentialities, primarily because of the problem of leadership. Yes, Mr. Box. Not Carl, that is.
Could you give us some of his relationship,
what
is connection with Martin Buber?
Well, I think that the relationship has always been a very friendly one. Of course, the great classic exchange is between Rosenstock, Husey, and Rosenzweig, Franz Rosenzweig, the great Jewish theologian who was a very close friend of Husey's. And after World War II, they engaged in the exchange of letters, which has become, I think, modestly famous, on the relationship of the Jewish and the Christian ethos, or how the two world missions were, if you wish, of Christianity and Judaism, and how they related to each other, and I think that his friendship, his relationship with Buber has been a warm one. I think that, well, they planned to get out a festschrift for Husey a couple of years ago for his 70th, on occasion of his 70th birthday, and he found out about it and killed it. But I think the people, who, well, he objected to it and said that he protested. But the people who were contributing to this, people like Reinhold Niebuhr and Tillich and Buber, represented people not, I don't think in most instances, influenced by Husey, but knowing of his work and regarding it highly. And Niebuhr's attitude toward Husey has always been a little ambiguous, and Husey feels that Niebuhr, in a way, has, by constantly arguing, you see, Niebuhr is a kind of precursor of John the Prophet, John the Baptist for Tillich. He's always been very much influenced by him. He remains more orthodox and not as fashionable. I don't think he strives as hard. He's kept his one foot in the camp of pastoral orthodoxy, if I could use that expression. But I think, again, Niebuhr, as in The Nature and Destiny of Man, is the intellectual theologian. You see, he starts out to destroy the by examination and review and critique, destroy the illusions of Enlightenment thought that he feels still prevail. And Husey has wanted to skip that step, you see. I mean, he's wanted to always speak as a kind of inspired and prophetic voice, and without directing his attention to the intellectuals primarily. And I think he's paid a price for it, of being, beside these other figures, relatively inconspicuous. I do think that he's far more original, and that he has a great deal more to say. As much as I respect Buber, I think he has much more to say that is of social import than he, or than indeed Tillich or Niebuhr. But I don't think that people are going to hear it for a while, because as I need to emphasize, he's on a rather unique wavelength, and you don't get him. Don't get the word fully. I mean, it's a whole view of the world, a whole language, a whole cosmos that is only in part comprehended. W.H. Auden, I know, has spoken of him as in his opinion, the outstanding philosopher and contemporary philosopher, and many company of goodly spirits view him as a highly important an original thinker. I don't think there's any question about his importance and his originality. How much of it will be taken up, how much of it comes through, is a big question, of course. No one knows. He feels very strongly his relative obscurity and anonymousness. He's had, I think, more. He's gone oddly, going back to Germany after the war. He's found more response and more reception, more warmer reception there, and this has, I think, disappointed him. Well, this not disappointed him in this, but he felt when he came to America, he wished to make this in every sense, to carry whatever he had to say into an American situation and to speak to Americans, and they, by and large, haven't wanted to listen. Before he came here, just before he arrived here, he was in Germany as a central, as a featured speaker of a conference of German business and professional people who are trying to promote the idea of international work service, of sending young people to the underdeveloped areas of the world in work service, and he's very much attached to this idea, as am I. Yes.
Can you give us any indication of what we'll expect on the final?
Practical question. No, I can't. I don't. I've taken a good many UC finals in my time, and always with in the spirit of some anxiety and humility. I think what he would be most pleased by is not your facile parroting of some idea of his, but some evidence that some thought or idea that he had given to you had been able in turn to apply to some area of your own experience. Of course, this is the problem in our academic world today, and those of you who've been in my classes have heard me speak about it. For the most part, students won't take seriously their own experiences, and people play with existentialism, but very few people are willing to be real existentialists. I mean, they play with it as a set of ideas, they don't think it's a fad, but it's what is essentially a fad. Husey is, if he has one great theme, it's that you only can discover yourself through your own experiences in the world, not by introspection and analysis, but by your activity and your life. And students, characteristically, and Dr. Meyer, and I've spoken about this in relation to his course, in relation to mine, have a terrible time doing this. They've been raised in an atmosphere, in an academic atmosphere, which has treated certain problems as being academic problems or scholarly problems. And this, of course, is not new. I mean, I think it's, if you wish, characteristically Greek. The sort of idealism, the influence of idealism, and not as... And of course, the curious paradox in this is that the schools have this dogma that you learn through doing, and the schools would say, well, our job, we teach the children by putting them in real-life situations, you see, and you get, instead of fairy stories, grim little accounts of Dick and Jane and their dramatic experiences in the family. This is a terrible thing to do to children, you know. I mean, they have to live in the family anyway. They don't have to read about it in the damn school. You don't want to do it, I don't want to do it. Family life is good and bad, but it is a strain. And you don't want to watch. You don't want to start off or end up reading about it. But it's this problem of making something, having the courage to make something out of your own experience. Husey cites the case of the professor in problem in family relations or whatever, domestic something or other, whatever it's titled, who starts out by saying, we're not going to have any personal experiences brought into this, you see. It's all on the abstract level, and so it's condemned to be meaningless, or at least fall far short of the meaning it could have for people. And this is all I could say. There's certainly nobody who has less of a formula. On the other hand, I've known a very good student who listened to Husey and got the word and were very much drawn to his ideas and sat down to write exams and wrote what they thought were very good exams and got grades that didn't satisfy them at all. And I've done it myself. So there's an element of risk, obviously. And that's very bad, of course, because we don't want any risk, particularly this kind of risk. We live in a world of calculation, and we have to, like the trained pigeon, peck at a certain place to get the grade that we want, and it's important to us, and so we want to reduce every element of risk and uncertainty to an absolute minimum, so that by doing in patient and scrupulous fashion exactly what we're supposed to do, we get exactly the reward that we feel we need. And of course, usually doesn't fit in to that system, fortunately. Yes?
Can you say something about his place in Christianity and general views on religion?
Well, I think he would consider himself, and I consider him, an orthodox, orthodox is not the right word either. If I were to try, and I've been trying to do it, because I've seen him in contact with, for the first time since he's been out here, with Protestant ministers of various denominations who are fascinated and dazed, you see, because they're still talking, the brightest and most informed of them are talking in Negorian terms, you see, and in a rather, some of them are even flirting with having illicit affairs with Tilling. But Husey is speaking of a language again that is mysterious to them, although from Husey's point of view, he's attempting to make Christian dogma directly relevant to every level of contemporary life in a way that I think no contemporary theologians have even understood, you see. I mean, our efforts have been in this direction have been, to my view, fumbling. There's no real sense of the involvement, the anxiety and the necessity, you see, of being involved in this experience. And either it's this, either religion, whatever the religion is this, or it's nothing, or it's very little. I mean, and this is a dilemma. The churches are full of people, but it's absurd, I think, to talk about a Christian revival or a revival of religion or whatever it may be. The synagogues are full of people, but this is just a surface manifestation. And Husey is trying, as I see it, to create a language which can bring these things, bring life and dogma together in the kind of unity that they once had. He talks every Sunday to a Bible study group that of mine at my church. And the effect there is the response has been, I think, a very interesting one. And he put out a little pamphlet for them on called The 12 Tones of the Spirit. And it's characteristically Huseyan. It's bizarre and eccentric. And it says, it tries to relate each, you see, to account for each phase of the individual's life and say how he fulfills himself at each stage, rather than, as we do today, treat the life in this segmented and interchangeable way. You know, I mean, that a person is, the symbol of it is the psychology test, which professes to say what a person is and is a profanation of genuine humanity. I mean, in this attempting to fix the person in the image of these absurd questions that they ask. Now, I couldn't explicate the 12 tones of the Spirit. I could only struggle with it, but it seems to me very rich in the kind of wisdom, the kind of insight that it offers about the relation of people to each other, the relation of parent to child, generation to generation, of old to young. You heard him speak on this question of the relation of the old to the young, and say that it's essential that our society come to some clearer and wiser view of this relationship. Otherwise, we can destroy ourselves through this infatuation with youth, which impoverishes youth, I think. Yes, Ms. Neal?
You said that no one... in America, do you think that he feels that people won't because they're overly critical of his ideas, or is it because what he has to say is beyond the comprehension?
Well, I think he feels it's a combination of things. The person that listens to him is not going to say, the average person is reluctant to say, and the more of an intellectual he is, the more reluctant he is to say, I don't get this. He say, I don't dig it, but he won't say, I don't get it. And in addition, of course, it's directed against many of the most cherished conceptions of the intellectual, what he has to say. I tell him, and like Job's comforter, the worst thing that could happen to you would be for everybody to listen and say, yes, that's wonderful, I think that's great, and I accept it completely, because then it wouldn't be anything of any importance. And it seems to me that he condemned himself. He chose a path by branching out. He could have spent his life in the vineyards of academic scholarship, turning out monographs and monumental works. He chose a path that, it seems to me, couldn't help but make him inaudible to the vast majority of his generation, of his time. Now, these things are all, I of course speak as a student and admirer of his. He's had a great influence in my own life and in my own thinking, and I don't pretend to any objectivity. I couldn't stand here and profess to be giving you some Olympian and impartial point of view about Rosenstock, you see. I think he has enormously important things to say, and I believe that we'll begin to hear them in time. But it's quite possible, of course, and I'm fully aware of that too, that he's simply an eccentric, a man, a charismatic, a man of enormous, to me at least, the minimum that you could say, spiritual, a moral, intellectual, a moral force, who simply is a cipher in the larger stream of events and ideas and so on. Yes.
Do you know of any 20th century literature that he admires or is interested in?
Any 20th century?
He tends to quote often books. I know he has War occasionally, and I just wonder.
Well, he's a very omnivorous reader. I don't know that I've discussed particular 20th century, you mean people like Faulkner or Hemingway or...
Well, possibly, but not necessarily. It could be playwrights, too. Anyone that he felt understood, even vaguely, society today?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, I think many, many voices. I mean, he admires, he understands and appreciates what Niebuhr is doing, what Tillich is doing, Buber, Jaspers, who was also, you see, and Carl Jaspers, the German existentialist, were ate lunch together at Heidelberg and were only a few years apart. Husserl, Heidegger. Heidegger. Well, I say the other night, hearing him talk about these people was fascinating to me because he placed them each, I mean, he had, whether rightly or wrongly, he saw each of them in a particular role. He saw Heidegger as having a very important role in making evident to young people again the spirit of excitement and of commitment as in existential terms or garb of being transported, of being picked up and swept away by an idea, by a vision, by an ideal. And this, he says, is a creation or a revival of the Greek spirit, and he feels that this is very, very sadly needed in our present day academic world. I think feel that each one of these people, he has a great deal of admiration for Buber. Buber's studies or Buber's I Thou thing is something that Hugo and his writings on the community are things that Hugo is very much in sympathy with. Yes.
Sir, can you give us his understanding of war and peace, an idea about it, how he connects them, gets out of them, and all this?
War and peace. Well, only very roughly, in that I think he feels that there's an artificial division between war and peace, and that the characteristic of Western liberal society has been to try and push war into the background and say this is an unfortunate, terrible aberration that has nothing to do with rational, enlightened man, and that it's a wicked business, and we just better ignore it. And I think Husey says that war has to be brought into life. It has to be a part of the, we have to live a campaigning existence, really, if we're not to have war. I know he was very much influenced by William James' essay, A Moral Equivalent to War, and that's why the camp was called Camp William James, because James in his essay says that these characteristics that war at its best brings out of self-sacrifice and loyalty on the personal level and involvement in some larger cause, these things are, people need to manifest them. They need to find expression for them. And this, James argues, this will have to be, we'll have to find a way in a peacetime society to give expression to these very worthy and very deep-rooted human needs and aspirations. And that's, of course, the thing that has interested him so in the work service camps. I think that the idea of work service, I think that it was James' essay originally in Germany that got him started on the idea there. Did I answer your question?
Not really.
No. What was it?
Because you see, his idea is when you are in war, in the same time you have to talk of peace.
Yes.
This I can't see it.
Well, you mean you don't think it's necessary to plan and have a vision of something that lies beyond the war?
No, I mean, when I'm in war with you, you see, I have no time to talk to you about peace. You see, I fight you.
Well, you have time, you have to find time to think about the solution. What, I mean, something lies beyond this. We as soldiers locked in personal combat may not have time to think
that's
about
what I mean. I mean,
our relations going to be to each other. And I don't think Husey means that, but he means that agencies of the society, responsible individuals in it, have to be able to see what will happen beyond and have to be able to carry this beyond this moment of tragic dilemma and conflict when the thing can't. I mean, there'll be a stage beyond this, and if we're not ready for it, then it'll be disastrous. We weren't ready for the peace after World War I. I often quote the phrase of Santayana, George Santayana, the nation that will not remember its history has to relive it. And Husey likes this phrase himself, I think. It expresses this idea that we have to learn from history, and we have to be always living ahead, you see. I mean, I think he feels that the most tragic or most dangerous tendency that confronts us today is to live from day to day, to live from year to year. Foreign aid is on a base year-to-year basis, and so you have to be ridiculous about it and call it mutual assistance, and you have to every year go through this travesty of winning acceptance for it. I say travesty. I mean, it should be something that we lay out for 20 years and say, this is what the American people have an obligation to do for mankind. And this, we're incapacitated, and we're the whole enterprise is compromised by this niggling day-to-day, year-to-year operation. And I think this is true throughout our society. We can't talk in academic terms beyond 10 years, and we usually can't talk about in any other terms except buildings. How many buildings will we need in 10 years? Really, it's just a scandal. You try to talk about what a university should be, and all you get is where you're going to put, what are you going to do about parking? And if we allow ourselves to be concerned with this is the essential problem, then they're really, we don't deserve any better fate than to be buried under the parking structure. Well, I don't hear a buzzer, but I think our time is up. I don't know whether I've deepened your confusion or can't reply.